Hello, and welcome to A Good Science Read, where we discuss science books written for the general public. I'm Professor Francis Ashcroft, and my guest today is Marcus Jussottoy, Simony Professor of the Public Understanding of Science at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of the Royal Society. Marcus is a distinguished mathematician with a particular interest in symmetry and number theory. He's also the author of several popular science books about mathematics, including the critically acclaimed The Music of the Primes, and he's presented numerous TV programmes. His book choice is A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy. Marcus, I was fascinated that Hardy begins his book by saying, "It's a melancholy experience for a professional mathematician to find himself writing about mathematics. There is no scorn more profound, or on the whole more justifiable, than that of the men who make for the men who explain. Exposition, criticism, appreciation is work for second-class minds." So that puts us firmly in our place. But given he says this, Marcus, what is the book about, and why did Hardy feel he had to write it?
Well, the intriguing thing is that Hardy is a sort of counterexample to that opening statement, because he's both one of the greatest English mathematicians of the 20th century. So he's right up there doing, you know, first-rate mathematics. But he's also a great communicator, and he always was throughout his life. This book is actually written towards the end of his life. And I think he was... I think he was actually during quite a depressed period, and that probably comes out in that opening paragraph. But actually, this is a book about what it means to be a mathematician and why he's a mathematician and what is mathematics. And so for me, this was a really seminal book in actually me becoming a mathematician, because it's a book my teacher in my comprehensive school, not so far away from Oxford. I grew up in Oxfordshire, but it was one of a few books that he recommended to me that he thought would kind of excite me about what it means to be a mathematician. And for me, the intriguing thing about this book is Hardy emphasizes the creative side of being a mathematician rather than the kind of utilitarian side. And for me, when I was a student going up to secondary school, I was falling in love with doing music, theatre, the arts, reading. But I also suddenly encountered the world of science and its power to explain the universe. And I was really torn between which two sides of my education, my character, I wanted to sort of pursue. And of course, at that time, and actually still currently, education sort of demands that you choose to be a scientist or an artist into the humanities. But this book kind of made me realize there was a way to do both, because for Hardy, he describes being a mathematician as a creative artist rather than a useful scientist.
But I found, you'll be horrified to find, that I didn't like this book very much, because I found Hardy pretty arrogant, and that really put me off. And I particularly disliked his dismissal of any science that has practical value as being of no real importance or beauty.
No, let me just correct you there, because that's not what he says. He says the mathematics that gets used is not interesting in the practical sciences. And I think that's a careful distinction. He's not dissing the sciences, but for him, the mathematics that gets used in those sciences is utterly uninteresting.
Yes. He seems to draw a distinction, doesn't he, between applied maths and pure maths.
And this is very old school.
And I think it is a very old-fashioned view, isn't it?
It is. And so this book was written at the beginning of the 40s. And still there was quite a division between the 1940s, we should say. There was still a big division between being an applied mathematician, where you got your hands dirty with oil and things like this. That was the perception, and the pure mathematician. And, you know, Hardy celebrates in this book the fact that none of the mathematics that he discovered would be at all useful, and he loves that fact. But he would be very surprised today to see that the subject he loved, prime numbers, the subject that I also study and have written a lot about, is fundamental to the modern world. They're used in cryptography to keep credit cards secure as you send them across the internet. So I'm not sure whether he'd be horrified or kind of quite excited to suddenly see these two worlds meeting. So this is a kind of slightly dated book in that respect.
Yes, and the other thing that he said was something like, there's one comforting conclusion which is easy for a real mathematician. Real mathematics has no effects on war. But of course, that's totally wrong now, isn't it?
Yes, but again, I think he argues quite interestingly towards the end of the book. He was deeply affected by the First World War. He was he made strong political statements which ostracized him within his academic community about the fact that we shouldn't be going to war. One of the reasons he came from Cambridge, Trinity College, Cambridge, to my college in Oxford, New College, was that he felt very unhappy in being left in Cambridge because of war. But he does argue that mathematics does have a place in war, rather frighteningly, and it actually sort of applied in the end to some of the things that happened during the Second World War, is that sometimes a horrific, isolated event may save more lives than a war that drags on for a very long time. So it's a sort of economics of war, and if you apply mathematics to the economics of war, sometimes what seems like a very unsavory decision actually, you can prove mathematically, is the one that's going to save more lives.
And by which I assume you mean the atom bomb.
Yeah, in the Second World War, it was the atom bomb. And for Hardy, he talks about the First World War and the many people that were killed in the trenches.
One of the main themes in the book, as far as I see it, is that pure maths has an inherent beauty. Can you explain what he means by this? What is this beauty?
Well, actually, it's quite hard to explain in a way. And he talks about that, that sometimes it's quite hard to identify why something is beautiful. But when you're in the presence of it, you kind of know. But I think it relates a little bit to that famous Keats quote about truth and beauty being related. But for him, beauty is about a certain elegance in proof, a naturalness in an argument. And I think it's important to highlight that proof is very important for him. And he believes that being able to prove something in mathematics is what sets mathematics apart from all of the other sciences, makes it a distinctly different sort of pursuit than anything else. And this is because you can prove things with 100% certainty, such that the discoveries of the ancient Greeks, as he illustrates, are as true today as they were when they were proved 2,000 years ago, and you can't say that about any other bit of science.
Actually, that last statement I agree with. But he actually writes about two proofs, doesn't he?
This is important.
The proof of prime numbers and Pythagoras's theorem. And he states, really, that this is something which is trivial that he can explain for everybody. But I have to confess, I didn't find his explanation particularly easy. My sister-in-law is a maths teacher, and she explained beautifully to me why this was. And she also was exactly like you. She said this was absolutely beautiful. But I frankly didn't see it like that. I thought it was elegant. I'm not sure why it's beautiful. And it's interesting because when I do science, when you suddenly see something for the first time, this is a huge excitement. But it isn't a beautiful thing. It's overwhelming, magnificent, like a rocket taking off in the sky with stars, coloured stars exploding all around you. But it is, I would not have described it as beautiful.
It's really interesting. So I think, you know, we're really identifying two different ways of being a scientist on either side of the table here, because for me, I certainly get those explosive moments. I can identify those moments in my life when I discovered a new mathematical symmetrical object, for example, and to be able to see that thing for the first time was, mind-blowing. But I think, it's really important, those two little proofs that are in the book, because they are what illustrate what mathematics is about. And one of them, I think, for me, blew my mind away when I read it as a school kid, which is the proof that there are infinitely many primes. And I think what the beauty of it is, infinity is something generally regarded as beyond the ability of a finite human to comprehend. It was always meant to be something unknowable. But here is mathematics showing you, hey, no, you can actually prove that something like prime numbers, these indivisible numbers, go on forever with a finite argument. And I think the argument is beautiful because it has a kind of moment of jeopardy. You assume there aren't infinitely many, there are only finitely many. You tease out what the implications of that are. There's a beautiful kind of aha moment when you produce a number which cannot be made out of the primes that you got in your list, and therefore there must be one you've missed. It's like a little Bach kind of prelude for me. It's got a kind of perfection about it, and a story and a drama and a moment where suddenly the thing turns and becomes something else. And I think for me, that resonated as beautiful. And also what was important to me, and I think this may be a difference, I cannot deal with uncertainty. And in science, I found that deeply unsettling, that you can never know. You can have a theory and all your experiments confirm that theory, and then 20 years down the line, something pops up which throws that theory out. For me, the fact that that proof 2,000 years ago, written in Euclid's Elements, proves that the primes go on forever. As Hardy says in this book, a mathematician is probably the only one who has a chance of anything like immortality, because once you've proved this thing, it exists forever. And so for me, proving that these symmetrical objects that I discovered, they are there forever. And also the proof speaks for itself. So a lot of scientists have to spend a lot of time doing PR for their theories. You know, you see the physics blogs, they're vicious. We don't have that in mathematics because the proof speaks for itself. So we can quietly sit behind. And I think that's why you find quite a lot of quiet people in mathematics, because they don't like the kind of fights that science can elicit.
I think science is very different in that respect from mathematics.
I think it is.
I'm not sure whether in that case one would classify mathematics as a science.
I don't.
It's something completely different.
Yes.
So, because after all, in science, it's not a static thing. And that's really important for people to understand, because it's only as good as the last experiment. And so obviously it changes all the time as we discover more and more. There are some things, though, which seem to fit for a very long time. You know, the sun is going to rise tomorrow, for example, and you can explain why that might be the case. But there are other things, especially in the life sciences, I think, where there's a lot of uncertainty. And I find that when I have students who come from a physical background, they always find this difficult, because biology is messy. You never have the exact same starting conditions, so your experiments will not necessarily turn out exactly the same way. And that's just the way it is.
And I couldn't deal with that. So biology, it is very messy. And I have a lot of respect for people who are able to navigate that kind of uncertainty. But for me as a school kid, I was after kind of the certainty. And when I read this book, Mathematician's Apology, it was... It showed me the thing that I should spend my life doing. And that said, you know, you said that science is not static. Mathematics isn't static either. And we're constantly discovering new things. And there are still great mysteries. And one of them is about prime numbers. Hardy dedicated his life trying to prove something called the Riemann hypothesis, which is still open. And that's the subject of the book I wrote, The Music of the Primes, which is actually celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. So mathematics, I think... people think is finished and static, but actually it's very dynamic. But we build on, I mean, genuinely, like Newton, I think, was reputed to have said, we build on the shoulders of giants. Those things which were done before are what we build on and will not disappear and fade into the distance. And I think that is...
But that's also true in most sciences. You build on the shoulders of giants. After all, it's very important that your theory, however it happens to be, or however new it is, actually also takes into account everything that's gone before. It's just that you found out new things. And I think one of the exciting things for me about my sort of science is that there's so much that's unknown. And it's a little bit like the branches of a tree. You start with the trunk, which is the one thing that you know, and you ask a couple of questions, and then suddenly you get massive arborization.
But that's the same in mathematics as well. There's a huge amount. You know, if you think prime numbers are the most basic things, they're like hydrogen and oxygen. We have, you know, in chemistry, you've got a periodic table. And in mathematics, we still don't have our periodic table. But I think the other really important thing, and Hardy talks about it in the book, is the fact that you can create worlds that have nothing to do with our physical world. And I enjoyed that creativity. Mm-hmm. He said, imaginary universes are so much more beautiful than this stupidly constructed real one. And I have to tend to agree with that because, you know, I feel that to be constrained by having to describe the physical universe around us, which is what science is interested in. If you come up with a theory which doesn't actually apply to the physical universe, nobody's particularly interested. But in mathematics, you can create geometries which are not ones that describe anything physically. And for me, that's the creative side of being a mathematician. You actually have so much more freedom, and people are interested in these things. And what's intriguing, of course, and this is what Hardy perhaps didn't understand, is that very often these very abstract, pure sort of pieces of mathematics very often land back down again and are things that the practical scientists suddenly said, oh, but that is what I want to know about that geometry, because it describes the way a biological process works.
Yes, but he actually argues that maths has a value independent of any possible application. But I don't think, I think one of the things that I found distressing about the book was this tendency that he has to basically put values on things. So pure mathematics is better than applied mathematics, which is better than physics, which is better than biology. And so on. I don't see the necessity to ascribe a value to anything.
Yes, but there's a wonderful XKCD cartoon about this hierarchy of the sciences. But actually, I think at its heart, it has something which I do truly believe, which is that I think that we are a physicalized piece of mathematics. So I do think mathematics is a fundamentally at the base of everything. And so this kind of idea that, you know, physics is applied maths, chemistry is applied physics, biology is applied chemistry, I think has a kind of logic to it, in the sense that everything actually has its root in mathematics. And that again, one of the other books my teacher recommended to me was a book called The Language of Mathematics. And that one, for me, kind of illustrated how to understand the sciences, you need this fundamental language.
So you're talking about what you did and learnt when you were a child. And I remember Hardy said something about no mathematician should ever forget that mathematics is a young man's game. Oh, by the way, before I carry on with what he said, he is very focused on the man doing this and he's doing this. There's never any suggestion that a woman might do it. But he does say that he doesn't know of any instance where a major mathematical advance was initiated by a man past 50. Do you think that's still true?
No, it isn't true. And in fact, I've just written an extra chapter for an anniversary edition of my book, The Music of the Primes, talking about what's happened over the last 20 years, which includes an incredible discovery which sort of came out of nowhere by a Chinese mathematician over the age of 50. And he proves one of the first major contributions to something called the twin primes conjecture, which is about primes coming very close together, like 17 and 19 or 41 and 43. These are twin primes. So, yeah, there are. I think the point is that you need intense concentration to do mathematics, and that starts to waver as you have family commitments, everything like this. But I think there's a lot of counterexamples to that as well. Yeah. I do want to actually add one thing, which is another important part of this book, which shouldn't be missed, which is actually a foreword. And I'm not sure whether your edition of this book had this foreword, but I think for me, it wasn't just a mathematician's apology, but a foreword written by C.P. Snow about Hardy, which I also enjoyed about this book. And it tells the story of Hardy and his collaboration with this Indian mathematician, Ramanujan. And that's a very romantic story. So for me, I think the combination of actually reading about mathematics, but also reading about mathematicians, was actually quite an important part of the whole package.
But I thought it was a very unfortunate story because he actually, he got TB in the UK and it was too cold and very uncomfortable for him. He had the wrong food. But I'm not sure they looked after him very well.
No, it was it is a tragic story. And Ramanujan actually attempts suicide because he's so desperate. Yeah. I mean, you know, the First World War kind of struck whilst he was in Cambridge. So it was a very, disruptive time in Europe. It seems now that actually he didn't pick up TB whilst in England, that actually what killed him was something that he'd already picked up in India, which developed. But it's true. It was a tragic story in some ways. But, you know, I think, I mean, we can't ask for managing this, but I think the things that he gained from coming were so extraordinary that he was a Brahmin, and leaving India for a Brahmin was a very serious thing. In fact, it was forbidden, and he had to somehow convince himself through the visitation of a family goddess that gave him permission to cross the water to go. But and, you know, wonderful things came out of that collaboration, and it is a very romantic story.
I agree with that. So finally, who would you recommend the book to?
Well, I would recommend it to somebody going up to secondary school to actually find out what mathematics is really about. And I think, you know, those two little proofs in there, I think, give a real quality of, you know, the power of mathematics to prove things are true. And also just somebody who wants to find a bridge between perhaps their creative, artistic humanities side and being a scientist, this for me was the perfect book. And as Graham Greene said about this book, after the Diaries of Henry James, this is the best description I've ever read of being a creative artist.
That's a wonderful ending. So let's move on to the next book. My book choice is Exactly How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World by Simon Winchester. It tells the stories of the pioneering engineers who developed the precision tools and the machinery that underpin the modern world. The degree of precision gets greater and greater as the book proceeds, from the development of a way to bore a clean hole in an iron cylinder to the manufacture of chips in our smartphones. Along the way, he asks questions like, why is precision important? How do we measure it? Can we be too precise? The book was shortlisted for the Royal Society Science Book Prize in 2018. Marcus, when I suggested this book, I'd no idea that in 2013 you'd actually made a documentary for BBC Four called Precision, the Measure of All Things. So what did you think of this book?
It's very interesting we've got these two books together, because I think they really do represent the two sides of being a scientist. So you found A Mathematician's Apology rather off-putting. For me, this is all the things I really don't like about science. So I really found this book incredibly boring. Now, that said, Simon Winchester is a fantastic writer, and that's what kept me going, because he's a great storyteller. So I'm not dissing Winchester's style of writing or what he has wonderful stories and he writes so beautifully, and even a boring subject he makes kind of compelling and what you want to read it. But for me, this is the obsession that I just cannot abide about science, is this kind of having to worry about these kind of silly little details of, you know, not being quite right, not being so close. I remember going to a science lecture, and it was a really exciting topic that was being talked about. But the lecturer spent 55 minutes talking about the accuracy of their measurements, and only 5 minutes. 55 minutes on whether this was how close they were to the actual true value of what they were measuring, and only 5 minutes on the actual result. So for me, it was very interesting. I really, as I read this book, I said, oh no, not another, you know, I'm not interested in how far you are away from getting the true value of something.
But the book isn't about that. The book is about engineering.
And yeah, I hate engineering.
And how we make the world.
Yeah, I'm so not interested in that. It's so interesting.
I love it. I thought the book was absolutely wonderful. I found it completely fascinating.
How
it was full of really interesting stories. It made me think, if only I'd had physics at my girls' school, I would have been an engineer. Because what could be more marvellous than building a bridge between two countries?
It's so interesting you say that. I was going to say that I remember in my sixth form, I went to a sixth form college in Oxfordshire, and my teacher was a little bit worried that I wanted to apply to do mathematics at Oxford. And he said, look, it's really difficult. You'll never get in. Why don't you do engineering? And I remember saying, I have no interest in building things. I have no interest in the practicality of science in the real world. I want to escape into the mathematical world. And he was like, oh, gosh, because his interests were engineering. So I remember even at that point, this sort of distinguished why I was trending towards Hardy's world and moving away from the idea of building things.
But I find it totally engrossing. So, for example, one of the things I learned, which I think is one of the most fascinating stories, is that the turbine blades in modern jet engines operate in gases which are far hotter than the temperature needed to melt the blades themselves. And you think, how can this possibly be? And when you're sitting there on an aeroplane about to take off and you know this fact, it suddenly makes you feel slightly nervous. But of course, what actually happens, so we learn from Simon Winchester, is that there are tiny little holes all over the surface of the blade through which cold air is channeled, coming from the intake of the plane, and so forms a cool barrier over the surface of the blade so that it never actually achieves the temperature of the gases that surround it.
In that program I made about precision, we went to Rolls-Royce. We saw they're beasts, these engines. And they showed us an interesting way that they measure the temperatures inside there, because it's very important to telling whether something catastrophic might be about to happen. And actually, of course, one of the stories that's told in that chapter about the turbine is an example of imprecision causing an extraordinary blowout of an engine, that one of the walls of this thing was a little bit thinner than the other side, and this actually resulted in a huge great breakdown. So, you know, which graphically illustrates why precision is important. And actually, they said when we went there that the temperatures do indeed go above, as you say, the temperature of the melting point of these metals. Really striking.
Yes, and then, but there's so many other wonderful stories he has. For example, the Hubble telescope, which, of course, that's a fascinating story, because when it was first, tested, the pictures came out blurry, which was absolutely horrific when you just think about how much effort and money and time had been put into engineering this thing. But they were just too flat, the edges of the mirror, I think, by, a 50th of the thickness of a human hair? And the problem was that although the mirror was ground absolutely precisely, the measuring tool was wrong.
Yes.
By about 1.3 millimetres. So it was precisely imprecise.
Yeah, exactly. It was, that is a fantastic story. And actually illustrates something that you need this standardisation of measuring implements to be able to do anything, because if you're working together, there are other classic ones where people work in meters and other work in inches, and they don't come together. But this they thought the tool that they were using was the right length, and it wasn't. And so that's why we have up to the modern age a meter which kept in Paris, which was the length that everyone else had to compare their meters against. Yeah. It's interesting that for me, I thought this was going to be a story very similar to the television program that I made about measuring the world, but it turns out not to be. The story that I told, which is, how do we measure the world and what are the units, this incredible thing that there are seven basic units, SI units, that we use to measure everything, is actually relegated to a kind of an appendix chapter at the end. And I think I enjoyed that chapter more because it was more about fundamental science than the engineering and the making of things, which felt more serendipity and more historical in a way, and reflecting moments in history when we needed weapons or we needed vehicles or we needed technology for our phones and things like that.
I suppose so. There is a lot of history. Which is fascinating.
It's a great way to tell a story.
I mean, the beginning of machine tools, a machine used to make a machine, all of that I found very fascinating. And I was also interested in his story about James Watt and the steam engine. As far as I recall, what had happened was he had built a steam engine, but the piston didn't fit in the cylinder absolutely precisely. So it was very inefficient because it leaked around the edges. But along comes somebody called, I think, John Wilkinson, who'd perfected this way of boring the barrels of cannons. And he wanted one of these engines to work for him. And then he realised that it was not very good. So he actually bored super holes using a machine that was possible. It was possible to do it with. And the consequence was that he had a highly efficient engine. And James Watt then said, right, all my engines are going to be made according to this method. And
Yes. But one of the interesting things that comes out in the book is the role, as you say, machines to make machines, is something which I think is very current to today's debate, which is the role of new technologies putting people out of jobs. And there's quite a lot of stories of, in the past, things would be handmade and each would be individual. And then actually, no, you want to make a gun where if a part of the gun, I think that's quite an interesting story where, you know, the guns were kind of bespoke made. And if a part failed, you had to throw the whole gun away. And suddenly, if you made parts precisely enough, you could just, the trigger's gone. I can just insert
a new
trigger in. And by that, having suddenly these machines making these things instead of people. And you see that again in the chapter, which is comparing Ford making cars and Rolls-Royce making cars, that the role of these machines putting people out of jobs. And that's, of course, so relevant today, where we've got a new kind of machine, artificial intelligence, which is really threatening a lot of now white collar jobs, in saying, well, you know, we don't need journalists anymore because these ChatGPT can write your articles for you. So it's kind of, I found that resonance quite interesting as I read the book.
Yes, I think the comparison between Rolls-Royce and Ford was really fascinating, because Rolls-Royce, they were very precise, but they built each car by hand. And so they would, you know, file it to fit if necessary. Whereas Ford, of course, wanted to build lots of cars as cheaply as possible. So he built it with interchangeable parts, all of which had to be precise in order that they would fit.
One of the stories I quite enjoyed was his opening one with his father coming with his beautiful set of measuring devices, sort of for standardization, and he puts two of these discs together, and the young Simon Winchester is amazed at just the precision of the flatness. Means that he can't pull these things apart;
yes.
They have to be slid apart. And then you get this story picked up kind of later about what these things were, and that they were a kind of set of kind of measures, which if you put them together in different orders, you could measure anything, you know, any number of things you wanted to. And I think that particularly appealed to me because it had a kind of mathematical quality to it, because it's like a little puzzle. And the chapter describes how the guy who came up with this suddenly has an aha moment and sees how many he needs in order to be able to combine them in different ways to count, sort of measure anything he wants to. And I mean, actually, can I send our listeners a little puzzle?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, because it's similar to a little puzzle, one of my favourite little puzzles, which is you've got a grocer and he or she has got a set of scales. So you put weights on either side and vegetables. But the grocer wants to be able to measure anything from 1 kilogram up to 40 kilograms. And the challenge is, what is the smallest number of weights the grocer needs to be able to combine them in different ways to be able to measure whole numbers all the way up from 1 to 40? And It's a lovely little puzzle, and it relates actually to that challenge of these set of weights, which actually Ford then realizes how important these are to the measurement in his factory, because there wasn't standardization and it caused a problem for him. So he actually bought the company that was making these set of measurement tools. But yeah, there's a little challenge for your
So
business.
How do they find the answer, Marcus?
They got to think mathematically, and they got to think. So this is an interesting way. You can either solve a puzzle like that by trying lots of different things out. And I think this is illustrative of different ways that people will approach a problem. And so sometimes it's a bit of luck, and you can see that in these engineering solutions. Okay. Sometimes it's sort of they weren't even looking for this thing and it pops up, or sometimes you need a strategy. And so in this case, you could do this by trial and error, but that's going to take you a long time. And that's where mathematics saves the engineer, is actually rather than, you don't want to build millions of bridges and see which one stands up. And why the mathematician is a very important player in an engineering sort of team is that we can actually solve the problem abstractly before you have to implement it in reality. So it turns out that you need to think in something called ternary rather than binary, and that will get you an interesting solution that you can actually do this with four weights. So there's your challenge. Can you find four weights?
Right. We'll leave that to the listeners.
Yeah. You can put it on the website or something.
I think one of the things which I found particularly fascinating was this idea of that you can actually perhaps be coming to a limit of precision, which is what he describes when he's talking about the computer chips.
Yes.
And I had no idea that you had so many transistors on a single circuit. 7 billion transistors? And the rooms in which they have to make the chips have to have so few dust particles. And we're almost at the limit, I think.
I think for me, that was when the book got interesting, because we were actually reaching questions of fundamental science again about not what humans have done on this earth and what they've made. That for me is less interesting than fundamental truths about the universe, which are we now believe that there are limits to how much information you can get at a particular scale. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle says that you have to give up knowledge about momentum in order to have knowledge about position. And if you want the momentum, you've got to give up knowledge about position. So that for me is really fascinating, that there might be, a measurement beyond which we think it might be 30 decimal places on a meter or something like that, beyond which you cannot know. I mean, that for me, it was getting really interesting. Yeah. And of course, you know, this is one of the big things which is hitting science and technology at the moment is quantum computing. And quantum computing arose absolutely out of the fact that people were trying to make tinier and tinier little components, and they were getting down to an atomic level, and suddenly they needed to factor in quantum physics into the behavior of an electron within these kind of such small components. And then it made people realize things behave very differently in a computer if you're at this sort of scale. But then there's an opportunity there.
It's also the case that they're now considering biological computers made
yes.
of, you know, tiny, tiny little proteins that are the things that power our nerve and muscle fibers. But I'm wondering, do you think that one can be too precise? Because going back to the idea of beauty, if you think about that, there is this Japanese idea, I think it's called wabi-sabi, where something which is beautiful has to be imperfect.
Yes, that's very interesting. I suppose, as a mathematician, precision for me in what I do is so important, such that any little fault in the logical argument is deadly. So I think it causes me problems, because I have difficulty kind of living in this world which is full of imprecision, and I've had to sort of deal with this kind of desire in my character for absolute precision and accuracy in mathematical proof versus the fact that many things are beautiful partly because of the damage. I mean, this idea that you break a vase in Japan and then you fill the gap with gold. You know, my wife is a psychologist and she uses this very much in her therapy because many of us are broken because of the lives we've lived and we need to live with that. And actually celebrating the faults is an important part of being human.
And it can also be more beautiful. I totally agree with you that in my scientific instruments or in the planes I fly in, I want absolute precision. But in the rest of life, because I'm very interested in studio ceramics, I would say that the ones which are handmade and therefore different or might have a slight flaw, which is actually only adds to the beauty. And I think it's called kintsugi, the Japanese
kintsugi,
art.
That's it, yes, exactly. Yes.
Of mending with gold. I think that's rather wonderful. And of course, there's plenty of people who play hundreds and thousands of pounds for watches that are handmade when they could have a quartz one that would probably keep time better without any trouble.
Yes, I think, you know, my other great passion is music, and I started learning the trumpet when I fell in love with mathematics when I read Hardy's book. And again, there, you know, I often talk about the connections between mathematics and music, but one of the distinctions is this idea of ambiguity, that for ambiguity is anathema to a mathematician, but ambiguity is absolutely essential for somebody engaging with a creative piece of work, because you want room for everybody's emotional world to be stirred in different ways by a piece of music, and for a piece of music to be played in many different ways. So there are interesting similarities and differences.
Yes, I think that's particularly true also of poetry
and
to some extent literature. Well, I think it's been a fascinating conversation, Marcus. I see that we have different ideas
Absolutely.
On these subjects.
Yes.
The books we've been discussing are A Mathematician's Apology by G.H. Hardy, which was written in 1940 and is republished by Cambridge University Press. We also discussed Exactly, or How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World by Simon Winchester, published by HarperCollins in 2018. You can catch up with more suggestions for a good science read on our podcasts, which can be found on the Oxford University website or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.